You're listening to a special edition of Midori House, recorded in San Francisco and first broadcast on the 19th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to this special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from KQED Studios in San Francisco, with me, Steve Bloomfield, Hugo McDonald and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up, we meet the man behind one of San Francisco's most ambitious urban projects, the Presidio Parkway.
And we look at the city's tech industry with Casey Newton, the San Francisco Chronicle's technology reporter.
Chad Robertson, the chef and owner behind Tartine, one of the city's most popular restaurants, is also here to tell us more about San Francisco's wine and food scene.
And finally, we've got entrepreneur and city visionary Rob Forbes in the studio to tell us why public space really matters.
So we're in San Francisco, in rather lovely studios.
It's very nice to be here.
it's an amazing studio complex, and we walked in by through loads of people making radio shows and have kind of nudged our way into a very nice big studio at the end.
I know, it's huge.
The corridor to kind of take over a bit.
By Gensler, which is a local design agency who are responsible for much of the retail and sort of travel spaces in California, across the states, and actually around the world as well.
Mm. And I like the fact that in the name of research, we went to Tartine, the restaurateur's restaurant coming up later on, and we ate lots of good croissants before we came here.
I had a morning bun, which was perhaps the best baked good I've ever had in my life.
And who wouldn't want a morning bun?
A morning bun. Yes, for our listeners who don't know what a morning bun is, it's a bit like a brioche soaked in sugar with
orange cinnamon.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very nice indeed.
Very nice indeed.
Yeah. And I had a croissant the size of a mobile home. I was thinking about just kind of lifting the lid on it and moving in.
and then we walked it off.
We slightly walked it off.
From there to the studios.
That is a good thing about it. We have been here for a couple of days and just we've kind of tried to walk as many places as possible. And it's an amazing city for walking around because it's very hilly. It's very good for firming the buttocks.
It is. And also you can see where it is you're heading to over yonder.
Well, some of us can.
the taller of those amongst the medical team can, yes, indeed. We've got lots to pack in over the next 50 minutes or so, including that chat with the owner of Tartine. But first, let's head back to Studio One in London for the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Parents of Jewish schoolchildren have expressed their shock and anger after a deadly attack on a Jewish school in Toulouse in southwestern France. A gunman on a scooter shot dead at least four people, including three children, at the Jewish school just days after three soldiers were killed in similar shootings in the same area. Monocle 24's Tom Burgess-Watson in Paris reported for us earlier on the briefing programme.
The third drive-by shooting in that very region of France in just a little more than a week. The two other shooting incidents, one was on Thursday, the other one 4 days prior to that. Thursday's shooting was about 50 kilometers away from Toulouse in a place called Montauban, and it was targeting soldiers who'd recently returned from operations in Afghanistan.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has described the crime as savage.
We can't rule out that there was strong murderous anti-Semitic motive here. I'm sure that Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, and his government will do their utmost to find the killer, and we in Israel will do everything to help them in this task.
Fierce fighting has erupted in Damascus in one of the worst clashes in the Syrian capital since the year-long uprising against President Bashar al-Assad began. Machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades have been heard from the heavily guarded district of El-Mezeh, home to several security bases. The Russian foreign minister has voiced clear support for a plan for daily humanitarian ceasefires in Syria and promised Russia would press President Assad's government to accept it. The head of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Jakob Kellenberger, said Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov clearly agreed to and was supportive of the idea of a daily two-hour cessation of hostilities to allow for life-saving aid operations.
Clearly, one priority is this humanitarian pause, or what you call humanitarian ceasefire. And I explained to him that has become even more urgent, because it cannot be that when you have the most intense fighting, you have not access to evacuate the wounded and to give assistance.
The state chief of India's eastern state of Orissa, Naveen Patnaik, has appealed to Maoists to release the two abducted Italian nationals. Unharmed there, Maoists are reported to have abducted the two From a remote district of Orissa, it's become known that they were taking photographs of tribal women.
My appeal again today, as it was yesterday, is that they be returned to safety immediately in an unharmed condition.
And I don't know what it's like in San Francisco, but an unseasonably warm winter has prompted an early bloom of cherry trees in Washington, in the United States, allowing tourists to get a jump start on the 100th anniversary celebration of the tree's arrival to the United States. Each year, the National Cherry Blossom Festival commemorates the 1912 gift of 3,000 cherry trees from the mayor of Tokyo. More than a million people visit the U.S. Capitol each year to view the blossoming cherry trees and attend events that mark the beginning of the spring season.
I'm in love with the cherry blossoms, and I planned the whole trip around them blooming, and half of them are here, but we're still excited to be here.
And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick Kelly.
Now let's head back to London again to get the World Weather Report from Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Well, in Western Europe, the weather looks promising. A few days of sunshine on the way for many major cities from London to Berlin, but it's a little on the cold side at the moment. Now, the weather won't be so great everywhere for the next 2 or 3 days if you're in the French Riviera or maybe in Spain, perhaps Barcelona. It'll be often cloudy with showers. So here's Tuesday's city outlook, both in London and Paris, 14 degrees with some sunshine. In Oslo, it's 11, partly cloudy. Zurich, 10 degrees, also partly cloudy. And in Barcelona, 14 degrees with a chance of rain. North America now. Last week was very warm across the eastern half of the US. More unusually warm weather to come first half of this week. Again, looks like Chicago will be getting up to 25, maybe even 28 degrees, at least until around Wednesday. Cooler thereafter. You might be jetting off to New York City. Some fantastic weather here as well. But in California, just like last week, very cool. But it shouldn't rain in San Francisco. Here's Tuesday's city outlook. New York City, 18 degrees and sunny. Feels like May, basically. Washington, D.C., warm too, 22 degrees with some sun. San Francisco, 13, some sunshine. Vancouver, 7 degrees with rain showers. And around the world, the Middle East, Abu Dhabi and Dubai, 29 degrees, sunny skies here. If you're off to Cape Town, hot sunshine, around 28 on average for the rest of the week. And in Sydney, sun and showers, and temperatures of around 25 Celsius. So that's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Now, we are going to be doing a newspaper review of sorts coming up very, very shortly.
But we're all reviewing the same paper. That's the only problem.
The San Francisco Chronicle.
There's heaps to go through in this.
There is. There's a lot to go through. But it is only one newspaper in San Francisco these days. Although there is an afternoon paper, isn't there?
Yes, but it's early morning here. So unless we've done the Friday's
news. It's
not
that early.
I know. Well, it's early for me. if we'd done Friday's news, we could have pulled in the other kind of Bay Area papers. But we're going to be sticking with a good thumbing of the San Francisco Chronicle.
Indeed. So we'll be coming back with that and our first guest right after this.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oo.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala
version. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to a very special edition of Midori House coming to you live from San Francisco. It's 11:09 here in the morning, and we've all got the San Francisco Chronicle in front of us, have we not?
Yes, we do.
Hugo, which bit are you looking at?
I'm looking at the business report. Actually, my eyes were drawn to a story by one of the guests we're going to have coming on the show in about 20 minutes' time. It's about a new site, a startup that helps other startups in the city find office space. And it's amazing that for all of the numbers of startups and entrepreneurs and thriving tech scene here in San Francisco, that the industry of finding office space for new businesses is relatively dinosaur. It still relies on faxes and flyers and spreadsheets.
Faxes?
Yeah. I just like the idea of Twitter starting and having to fax to get office space in its infancy.
That's quite a nice little idea.
I know, but we can talk to Casey Newton about that.
We can indeed. Andrew, what have you got?
I also wanted to pick up on a story which is in the business pages, which is a report from the Project for Excellence in Journalism. And they've been looking at the trends in the newspaper industry. And obviously it's slightly ironic that it's carried by a paper that's been threatened quite a lot by the kind of move to people reading on tablets and new technology. But it's saying that, in fact, they think there's actually hope on the horizon because people are reading for longer and deeper on their tablets. And they're going to old traditional news sources for that information. And they also point out that they think that in the future, this report says, that potentially there'll be more alliances between new tech and old tech. And they see a future where Facebook, for example, would step in and start buying up newspapers because it needs the information being fed through to it to make sure that it's got enough information. And then just one other tiny thing, which is just, I think it's just a nice hint at, you know, you forget that this is really still a big trading port. And inside they've got a nice little thing they publish every day, which is called Ship Traffic. And it just logs all the ships arriving in the ports today.
Really?
Yeah.
Where are they coming from?
Yeah, how
well,
many?
Unfortunately, quite a lot of them are just coming up the coast. They're coming up from Los Angeles, but there's the APL Canada will arrive in Oakland today from Taiwan. And the Oriana is coming in from Mexico. And then that's leaving today.
I love it. Although I worry a little bit about the surfers under the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yes, we'll talk about them in a moment. I just want to very quickly point out something on the front of the Chronicle, which is about Republicans in San Francisco having a big makeover. Do you know Republicans are outnumbered by Democrats here in the city by 5-1? Only 9% of San Franciscans say they're Republicans.
I mean, they're having a makeover in how they look, or they're getting new suits, or
as in the people that are their leaders now. Oh. So everyone from a devout Sikh to many more gay Republican leaders. So quite an in-depth story there. I mean, they're all admitting they're not going to win, but that they need to fight.
Now, while the Golden Gate Bridge may be San Francisco's most iconic structure, the 1930s roadway leading up to its southern end has been found to be both structurally and seismically deficient. Launched in 2009, the Presidio Parkway project will not only replace the original faulty road, but also allow direct access to the natural parkland that adjoins the bridge itself. Having spent 30 years in transport and infrastructure design, José Luis Moscovich is overseeing the plan that is set to be completed in 2015. José Luis, thank you for joining us in the studio. Maybe you could start by just giving us a little rundown of what the Presidio Parkway project actually consists of.
Gladly. It's the south access to the Golden Gate Bridge. It's essentially a roadway that is under 2 kilometers in length, with 6 lanes of traffic. And as you well said, it's being redesigned now so that it provides direct access into the Presidio, which is our largest urban national park in the country, in a way that doesn't necessarily just favor the automobile, so that people in public transportation vehicles can get into the park as well, and that we facilitate the movement of pedestrians and bikers and others who want to use the park and access the bridge, but also the neighborhoods adjacent to the park as well.
And we were down there yesterday, actually, having a walk around, and it feels like that area is being sort of very, very heavily used by people in the city.
Oh, absolutely. Crissy Field, which is the beach and marsh and bird habitat next to it, is one of those marvels that you find in San Francisco. You're very, very close to downtown, and yet it feels like a natural preserve. And so it has become a very popular location for people to go jogging and even access the beach, even though the water is not at a nice temperature here. But
no, it didn't look. It looked fairly cold.
Yes.
So I was just going to say, I mean, actually, when we were down there, what's amazing is we actually saw amongst the surfers a giant seal or sea lion riding through the waves. Because our producer, Aisha Spears, she's good at spotting them anywhere in the world. She said, "I bet I'll see one." And there it was.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing. My first memory of Crissy Field after it reopened as this wonderful boardwalk was seeing a formation of 5 huge pelicans flying against the wind, so motionless essentially, without flapping their wings, about 6 inches above the water. in perfect straight line formation, fishing, right?
Amazing.
Right in front of the beach. Gosh. Really amazing.
And also, actually, while we're talking about local nature, is there quite a lot of sharks in that part of the beach as well?
I don't know of any shark warnings inside the bay. They tend to stay
on the other side of the bay.
And even that is fairly rare.
Okay, I'd also like to go back to the Presidio Parkway project. Before we get distracted.
Now you know that it's safe to swim.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now we've done Nature Watch.
But I mean, this is part of a sort of wider addressing of problems that the traffic in, not just in San Francisco, but in so many cities around the states, where people are beginning to look at ways to reclaim areas that have just been sort of used for cars or given over to cars. This is quite a pioneering project in that, in terms of people looking at the success of it. Have you had to fight quite hard to push it through?
This is an unusual project in many ways. When I first got acquainted with it back in 1994, I think it was an orphan project. It's part of the state highway system, but San Francisco has been known for its penchant for demolishing freeways rather than building them, and we've done quite a bit of that. So there wasn't any real advocacy from the local level to rebuild something that was considered a freeway. So we had to go through a very lengthy process, what I call transportation therapy, to first admit that it is in our midst, figure out a way to redesign it so it fits better for the purposes of today. Remember that when it was built, it was flying over a military base. You know, the Presidio has had military presence since the 1700s, since, you know, Spanish times. So this was about not restricting access, but providing access into the park. So it had to be redesigned completely. And then we had the issue of noise and the issue of visual intrusion. The bridge is, I think, the most iconic bridge in the world, not just in the U.S. Or it's really something you don't want to have an ugly concrete building in front of that doesn't allow you to see the bay and the bridge. So we had to redesign it. And it, as you may have seen from the field tour, it now has four short tunnels that allow the road to dip under the park and reconnect the area of Crissy Field back into the main post, the historic heart of the Presidio. So you get a completely different feel, even though the and this is a key point, the facility provides all of the transportation capacity that it has to provide, because you are feeding this enormous bridge that serves 140,000 trips a day. So the reality of getting people from here to there needs to remain. And the question is, how do we create a design that works for it and that over time can be maintained, so that we're not doing this sort of developing world thing of building something, then non-maintaining, and then having to rebuild the same thing again instead of moving on to the next thing.
So it actually eases the flow of traffic in and out of San Francisco, as well as connecting the parkway.
That's right. And it does have other functions, connecting the southwest part of the city to the northeast. You know, there is an amount of traffic that happens within the Presidio Parkway that doesn't go to the bridge. You know, that is important for connectivity as well as access into the park itself.
Of course, and it's set to complete in 2015. Is everything on track?
Yes, everything is on track. We have a very interesting construction paradigm in place for it. The first half, which you visited today, is poised to open. The moment that opens, there will be a cutover of traffic. There is a detour that provides that flexibility. Then we will demolish the northbound lanes, the old oil drive, and build a new northbound structure in its place. And that second part is going to be done as a public-private partnership. It's a very different way of delivering projects than what we're used to in the U.S. You guys know this because in Europe, and particularly in the U.K., is fairly common. But for us, it's an opportunity to really take into account the life cycle costs of the project, not just the construction, but the maintenance, so that when the concession is over in 30 years, we have a facility that's in really good shape and continue using it.
Fantastic. Well, I can't wait to see how it develops. Jose Luis Moscovich, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be talking to Casey Newton of the San Francisco Chronicle right after this.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Tokyo, Kenji Hall covers Japan and beyond.
I've kicked the tires of the Taiwanese president's motorcade, and in the span of just a couple of weeks, I've swung through more than a dozen cities across Japan, from Hiroshima to Sapporo for Monocle's Japan Guide. The best part, though, is that I get to live in Tokyo. There's really no better city to get lost in and to mingle with world-class architects, artists, and artisans. It's a city where food and fashion are a religion, where designers like Naoto Fukasawa turn everyday products into art.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall, our man in Tokyo.
The Menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks program with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and sometimes weird tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The Menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, Andrew Tuck and Hugo MacDonald. It is 11:21 here in San Francisco. Now, we couldn't visit the city without talking about technology, and our next guest has a better handle than most on the tech innovations and inventions that make San Francisco tick. As technology reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, Casey Newton has watched numerous startups hit the big time and many others burn and disappear. And he's here now to tell us about the city's unique role in constantly rebooting how the world works. Hello, Casey.
Hello.
Let's start not with a startup, but with a behemoth, with Apple, who've just announced what they're going to do with all this cash they have. And you've just been writing about this. Literally minutes ago.
Just moments ago. That's right. The $100 billion question for Apple has been, what are they going to do with all of this money? Investors have been clamoring for them to do something with it for years now. And finally today, they said that they're going to do two things. One, they're going to start paying a dividend, $2.35 a share each quarter. And two, they're going to start buying up some of their stock back. And so over 3 years, they're going to spend $45 million on those two initiatives. What's interesting is if you look at how much money Apple is projected to make over the next couple of years, they're still going to wind up with more cash at the end of the program than they have today.
So they can afford to do this?
They can, absolutely.
And so does that mean Apple's got some rather happy shareholders then today?
They do. It's important to remember that there are some investors that simply will not buy stocks that don't offer a dividend. For many investors, dividends are a source of income that they rely on. So Apple just sort of sat outside the bounds of what they could consider. This is expected to bring some new investors, particularly pension funds, into the mix.
And how has this affected Apple's share price?
Well, the last I checked, right before I came into the studio, it was up about 2%. Analysts will tell you that most people expected that Apple would institute a dividend, and so some of that was built into the price of the stock. It was not too much of a shock that they did it. When you have as enormous a cash reserve as Apple does, there are only so many things that you can do with it. So most people were expecting some kind of dividend.
Now let's talk a little bit about startups. Hugo mentioned earlier today one of the stories that you wrote in today's paper about a new startup. Are you sort of inundated with press releases and emails and calls from startups every day?
Absolutely.
And how do you work out which are worth writing about and which are just nonsense?
You know, that's a great question, and I think it's an evolving process. I'm always looking for the kind of startup that I would tell my mom about, right? Because, you know, my mom is, you know, in her 50s and sort of tech savvy, but doesn't care about it a whole lot. So I try to ask myself, what would grab her attention? I also look for entrepreneurs who've been successful in the past. And I look through entrepreneurs who've gone through some of the most successful startup incubators in Silicon Valley. And 42 two floors, which I wrote about today, went through Y Combinator, which might not be widely known outside of Silicon Valley, but within Silicon Valley is known for being a source of some of the bigger startups that we have. For example, Dropbox, which has become pretty popular around the globe, Airbnb, another San Francisco startup, which kind of helps people rent rooms. Both of those started at Y Combinator and have gone on to become companies with billion-dollar valuations. So that's something else that I look for.
And what do you think is at the heart of San Francisco that makes it a culture that works for all these startups? You know, we went out to dinner last night. We met an English guy who's moved here a year ago. He's already involved in the company in a kind of very meaningful way. It seems to attract people from all around the world who are desperate to work here. What is it that happens in San Francisco that really makes this work?
Sure. It's a great question. I think it's a couple things. One that you can't discount is money. This is where venture capital is. Two is the venture capitalists you have here are willing to place long bets, right? The people who first invested in Facebook were investing in a company that didn't really have very much of a business model. Many investors passed on Facebook at first because they didn't understand how you could ever get an enormous company just by selling really lame ads against people's profiles. But the companies or the venture capitalists who are willing to place those big bets are now going to reap billions of dollars. So there's money and there's a certain willingness to invest in those kind of companies. I also think what you find in San Francisco are people who are relentlessly dissatisfied with the status quo. I remember once I was talking with... Yeah. I remember I was interviewing Jack Dorsey once. He co-founded Twitter and later Square, and Square had unveiled a new product. And as he was talking with me about everything that he hated about cash registers, it occurred to me that I had never had a problem with a cash register before. you go into the store and you pay your money and you walk out. And Jack Dorsey spent enormous amounts of time just hating the whole transaction process. That's kind of in the DNA of San Francisco startups.
Casey, I'm glad you mentioned Jack Dorsey there, because I was reading about him on my way over here and about Square and how in such a short space of time it really is taking off. And I was in the back of a taxi yesterday and noticed that they accept Square payments, I still can't really get my head around how it works. It's through a mobile phone that you scan?
Sure, absolutely. So Square makes what they call a dongle, which is a white plastic square. It plugs into your smartphone and it serves as a card reader. So you swipe it through and then Square is able to process that transaction. And one of the reasons it's been successful is that there are many small merchants out there who haven't wanted to go buy all the complicated machinery that it takes to accept credit cards. And also credit card companies charge very big fees. Can really take a big bite out of the bottom line. So Square introduced a flat fee. So it's actually finally economical for a lot of small businesses to finally accept credit card payments. So within the last year, the guy who cuts my hair has started accepting Square. Makes it great for me because I don't have to bring in a bunch of cash to the salon anymore. And for him, he gets a lot of analytics and other data about his customers that previously would have been totally unavailable to small businesses. So it's just, those are a couple of the reasons why it's really taken off.
And do you get a sense that sort of relentless dissatisfaction is still here in abundance and that's not changing?
Absolutely. I asked an entrepreneur at Google not long ago whether we were in danger of running out of problems. because we had this enormous bubble in San Francisco last year with photo sharing apps. So just apps on your phone, they had names like Color and Batch, Instagram. Instagram has actually been very successful. But there were a large number of these apps that were getting tens of millions of dollars with no foreseeable business model. There's at least none that I could figure out. So I said, are we in danger of running out of problems? He said, no, there are plenty of problems. Just look around you. And he started rattling off problems in, healthcare and energy, biotech. And so I'm seeing, tons of pitches every day from startups who are convinced that there are problems that they can solve. And in many cases, they're doing quite well. When I look at the number of businesses in San Francisco that have risen to valuations of $500 or $1 billion over the past couple of years, it's really pretty impressive.
Casey, can I quickly ask you, it's interesting that you write for a newsprint, for an old piece of media. You're writing about the kind of the white heat of new technology. Is that something that's a bit of a contradiction sometimes when you're going out reporting?
You know, it's interesting. What I find is that startups absolutely love to be featured in our paper, right? There's something substantial and real about a newspaper that's been in the city for more than 100 years that I think gives them a stamp of credibility, or at least I hope they feel that way. Many of them have shared that with me. And I think the Chronicle is doing what we can to be part of the new media. We have an iPad app. You can subscribe to it, which makes that we can make real money off of our content on some of these new devices. Our website, SF Gate, has more than a billion page views a year. And many of us are very active on Twitter, on Facebook, and on some of the other social networks so that we can bring our content to where readers are. None of that prevents the economics of journalism from continuing to be brutal. But I think that, you know, the Chronicle and other older media outlets are doing what they can to continue to be part of the conversation online.
Casey Newton, the San Francisco Chronicle, thank you very much for coming in. It is 11:30 here in San Francisco, and you're listening to Midori House. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking about food and bikes with two more San Franciscans.
But first, let's head back to London for the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Andrew. A gunman on a motorbike has shot dead at least four people, including three children, at a Jewish school in Toulouse, just days after three soldiers were killed in similar shootings in the same area of southwest France. Rebels fought government forces in Damascus today in the most violent gun battles the Syrian capital has seen since the start of the year-long revolt against President Bashar al-Assad. South Korea has condemned rival North Korea's planned rocket launch as a grave provocation, saying it was a disguised attempt to develop a long-range ballistic missile capable of delivering nuclear weapons. Indonesian police have shot dead five suspected militants planning attacks on the resort island of Bali, including an assault on a nightclub popular with foreign tourists. Up to a million followers of the Iraqi cleric Muqtadir al-Sadr have taken to the streets of Basra in a massive show of force before an Arab League summit, which Iraq's long-oppressed Shiite majority view as their debut on the regional stage. Greece's Evangelos Venizelos said today he was stepping down as finance minister to lead the socialists into a general election, a day after taking over the helm of the party, which is trailing far behind its rival conservatives in opinion polls in Greece. Guinea-Bissau's former head of military intelligence was shot dead at a bar in the capital Bissau overnight, just hours after a peaceful presidential vote. The Libyan Deputy Prime Minister Mustafa Abu Shagour has arrived in Mauritania to press for the handover of Muammar Gaddafi's feared intelligence chief Abdullah al-Sanusi. And Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney has swept to a big win in his party's primary in Puerto Rico, bolstering his position as front runner in the race to decide who will face Democratic President Barack Obama in the US November the 6th election. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
It's 11:32 here in San Francisco, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, Andrew Tuck, and Hugo MacDonald.
Opened in 2002, Tartine Bakery and Cafe has become one of San Francisco's most popular destination restaurants, known for its fresh ingredients and baked goods. Husband and wife, chefs and owners Chad Robertson and Elizabeth Fruitt also run Bar Tartine, sourcing wines and beers from local producers. Chad is here to tell us a little bit more about San Francisco's food scene. Chad, thank you for coming in. We came to Tartine this morning and stocked up on good baked goods ourselves and had lots of coffee. Can you tell me what makes for success in San Francisco for a restaurant?
San Francisco, it's a small town, and we have a lot of good produce and a lot of good chefs are very tight-knit community. I think success comes from utilizing sort of the bounty of produce and things that we have here and really sort of putting that in the forefront of the food that you make.
So what you seem to be offering is kind of a kind of mix of great ingredients, some heritage, a great capacity to make simple things, but it's not a flash experience going into Tartine. It's you could see everyone loved it. It felt community. It felt a good neighborhood place. Are those important ingredients also for being a success here in San Francisco?
Absolutely. I think the bar is pretty high. You know, at Tartine, we sort of make everything in small batches all day long, and so when you come there, you sort of have this vibrant atmosphere of being in a restaurant, even though it's a bakery, but we have people sort of baking things in real time all day long. So it's a dynamic, atmosphere you find there.
And Chad, something that strikes me about San Francisco is people are prepared to queue for hours and lines and lines and lines, and particularly yesterday on a Sunday where brunch is a very big deal, queues stretched right around the block.
We're very fortunate that way. The whole block actually has lines now. We have lines at Tartine, we have lines at Bayreuth Creamery across the street, friends of ours. There are lines at the pizzeria, and there's a new place opening on the opposite corner on Dolores Park. Other friends opening a place called Namu Gaji, and I'm sure they're going to have lines. It's going to be difficult, I think, figuring out which way all the lines go. It's going to wrap around.
Are people just very patient then here for great food?
You know, it's funny because I have friends from New York who come here and they really are perplexed at how people
can't we just book? We'll
do this. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was reading you're actually a Texan. You're not from here, and you trained in France. You've been a bit around the world to kind of make the kind of the success of your restaurant. Do many of the people who come here to cook, are they drawn from around the rest of the U.S. because it's seen as a good place to be a chef?
I think that's always been the case now more than ever, because we're a lot of chefs from San Francisco are taking cues from what's happening in Scandinavia with some of these restaurants that are using their local produce and all of their ingredients, but creating a kind of post-regional cuisine that really isn't easy to classify. And it's kind of a natural progression to do that here in the Bay Area because we have such a wide variety of produce. So it's kind of, I feel like here in the Bay Area now, even compared to New York, it's there's a lot of interesting sort of exploration going on with cuisine.
I was in Scandinavia recently, actually, in Finland, where in Helsinki it's very difficult to open a restaurant, and it's sort of seen quite a stranglehold of a few big players. There's a certain group of people who are trying to change that. But in San Francisco, it seems like it would be completely the opposite, actually, that it's very easy to open a restaurant.
It's easy. The one thing that chefs here for the last, I don't know, maybe, I mean, we have a whole generation of chefs that grew up with this sort of Chez Panisse mantra of local and organic, and we have such an amazing vast network of farmers and producers to deal with, but it also the cuisine was sort of defined as this California Mediterranean thing that we're sort of starting to move beyond in that not forgetting it but building on it by exploring new flavors.
Let's talk about your own experience. When you set up Tartine in 2002, I mean, what were the particular challenges you had to overcome before you could, you know, open the doors for the first time?
Tartine, we opened, we had a pretty straightforward idea of what we wanted to do. Before that, we had been baking, my wife and I alone, basically me doing bread in a wood-fired oven and Elizabeth doing pastries in the wood-fired oven at a lower temperature after all the bread. And it was very focused, a few farmers markets per week, and then we were able to move into the city after 5 or 6 years of doing that, and you know, we basically adapted. In the beginning, we weren't busy at all. There wasn't much daytime business on that block, so we sort of kept changing and adapting what we did until it seemed to fit the sort of needs of the neighborhood, and then, you know, now we have lines. So
And I was just going to say, if someone was coming here from outside of the city, from Europe or from Asia, what would maybe your top two or three food experiences in the city that you think people should really kind of go and see to understand what makes San Francisco work?
Right now, one of my surf friends has a restaurant called Outer Lands out near Ocean Beach at 46 and Judah, and the chef there, Brett Cooper, is doing amazing stuff. He's making very approachable food, but kind of what we've been utilizing all this produce and pushing the flavors in a creative direction, like what I've been talking about. He's a good example of what's going on in town right now. And other friends, Stuart Briocha and Nicole Kraczynski, a couple that opened this place called State Bird Provisions, that are really doing their own kind of food, and again using this vast array of ingredients and flavors that we have, and they're serving their food in a sort of dim sum style with carts that come around, so they're making these small plates. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful expression of the sort of modern Bay Area cuisine.
And you mentioned before that around the block where Tartine Bakery is, that there's lots of things happening that have happened recently and things about to happen. Since you opened in 2002, that area presumably has gone through quite a big transformation itself. Is it, I mean, the room for so many new bars and restaurants, or does it begin to reach overload?
Our block is kind of reaching overload. Like, literally, it's the lines are going to, I don't know what's going to happen. The lines are sort of having to redirect, and I don't know where they're going to go.
Clashing with each other.
Around the park, exactly. But that kind of sort of quality growth is happening on other parts of Valencia, and it's beautiful because there's a lot of talk about gentrification, but it's all small businesses so far being created by people that live there and work there. So it's a good time. It's a good time for the mission.
How important is the kind of cultural mix of the city? You know, that as you walk around, you see there's Japanese restaurants, Chinese restaurants. It doesn't seem that it's all kind of walled off. It seems that everyone's borrowing from each other's cuisines a bit. Do you find that there is a good flow of ideas between all these different cultures in the city?
Yes, I do see that. Even more than ever now, I see people sort of taking, especially people in the mission. Another friend of mine, Danny Bowen, who has mission Chinese food, he takes a lot of influences.
We went for dinner last night.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It was great, yeah.
And it's Chinese. I mean, he describes, every time I ask him, he describes his own food differently. You know, it started out as sort of Muslim Chinese, and then he puts Southern barbecue into it with glazing with Coca-Cola, and he kind of does whatever he wants. He's a very talented chef, so he has the freedom to do that.
And Chad, I was reading yesterday in the Sunday edition of the San Francisco Chronicle about Tartine that you've had a bit of a shift in the food that you serve in the diner as well.
Yes, that restaurant's been open almost 6 years now, and I was a big fan of our current chef, Nicholas Bala, who was making Japanese food before. And when he decided to leave that restaurant, I had another chef that was moving on from Bar Tartine, and I asked him if he wanted to do something. And he said, yeah, I'd love to work with you guys, but I don't want to do Japanese. I'd like to do, Eastern European, Hungarian or something. So the next week, Nick and I were going to Copenhagen, Budapest, and Stockholm, and we both sort of came back with a lot of ideas of this, what I was saying, sort of post-regional, sort of being free to forge new direction.
So that's quite a shift from Japanese to East European.
It's quite a shift, and believe it or not, there's a lot of sort of crossover and technique that he was able to,
really?
To make sense. Yeah, it's interesting, but true.
And then just on the drink front, I know that you're doing a lot of work with beer producers, but there's an extraordinary range of winemakers outside the city. The funny thing is, the number of restaurants we've already been in where, in fact, the wine list is quite French or Italian. I'm surprised how you'd think there'd just be pages and pages of great Californian wines, but people do seem to kind of look to Europe still for a lot of their wine, even here.
It's true. That's always been sort of a disconnect with being, using all local produce, but still going towards European wines. And part of it is just the fruit forward, high alcohol California wines that maybe don't go so well with the food over time. But I feel like that sort of California wines are becoming more food friendly, and there's a little more collaboration between chefs in the Bay Area and the winemakers than there was before. So that's all changing, actually.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. But Chad Robertson, thank you very much indeed for coming in. You're listening to a very special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from San Francisco. And we're back in a moment.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about it. What are these crazy ideas going around in my head?
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions. That's The Entrepreneurs every Wednesday at 1900 UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
It's 11:44 here in San Francisco, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Hugo McDonald, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck. Rob Forbes founded Design Within Reach and brought good design from Europe and beyond to thousands of homes across America. In 2010, he launched Public Bikes with a similar mission to transform cycling culture. Forbes imports bikes both from Europe and designs his own and sells them from his South Park store in San Francisco and online. He joins us now in the studio. Rob, thank you very much for coming in.
Great to be here. Thanks.
I wonder if you could start just by telling us a little bit about Public Bikes. It's been 2 years pretty much since you launched it.
We're just in our ending our second year, yeah. We've been actively kind of building and supporting the bike culture here, both here in the Bay Area and also around the U.S. It started as a simple concept to make it very easy for someone to purchase a simple, practical, elegant city bike, both online and also from our headquarters and store. And we're also selling our bikes through about 20 different retail locations around the U.S.
Right. And these are bikes, I mean, I spoke to you when you'd started it up before. And they were bikes that you were importing from Europe that had a very sort of elegant city feel to them.
Actually, the designs are imported from Europe. We really took a classic Parisian model from the 60s and a Dutch model from the really kind of from the 40s, and we designed them off of them. And they're actually manufactured in Taiwan. So it's a European approach to cycling, but most of the production of high-quality production bicycles are done very well in the Far East.
Yeah. And do you notice that cycling culture has taken off? I mean, here we see a lot of bikes. I'm always surprised that so many people do cycle in San Francisco at the hills.
Right.
But it seems to have really gathered pace quite quickly.
There are a number of influences, and one is the phenomenal San Francisco Bike Coalition that has been a very actively building membership. We have the largest bike coalition in the U.S. despite the small size of San Francisco. I think also that bikes sort of beget bikes. You know, people often sort of say, well, how can you bike around San Francisco, all these hills and the cable cars and all that stuff? But you see so many people on bicycles, so it allows someone to look and say, hey, I can look like that, or I can do that, or here's a very reasonable alternative to the way that I might get around in terms of cars and things like that. But I think that there's a just terrific culture here that's been propagating. And similarly in New York and Portland and Minneapolis, and I think in London also. I mean, someone say London is not that habitable, hospitable place for riding bicycles, but when you see more people doing it, then it becomes just more simple to adapt
that
way.
Momentum, safety in numbers.
Yeah.
Talking of safety, was San Francisco home to critical mass? Not very safe.
Critical Mass was launched in San Francisco, I believe, maybe like 12 or 15 years ago,
yeah,
as a movement, and it's both helped and hurt, I think, the position of cyclists and the respect for bicyclists and all that, because it's it's more of a confrontational kind of approach to getting people to think differently about the way they get around the city, where we tend to look at it more like put a smile on your face and try to figure out a way to be compatible and work together that way.
Yeah, don't run over small children crossing the road.
Right.
Yeah.
Although that must be quite hard. I mean, we were talking about the hills. It strikes me as a hard place to go down the hills because they're ridiculously steep, and who knows if you're going to crash. And surely there's a lot of let's get off the bike and walk up this very steep hill.
Yeah, I think it works that way, but they're really really elegant streets, a kind of a network that allow you to kind of circumvent the large hills, and so you can go from one side of the city through different kind of paths that are bicycle friendly. And I live on the top of the hill and kind of enjoy the exercise, but I think very few people have to really confront them too often if they don't mind a little more distance.
And have e-bikes taken off here at all, electric bikes, or is there, that still sort of quite
I think
early
we'll be
stages?
In a good growth mode in 4 or 5 years. No, they've swept through Europe. But people there are far more accustomed to cycling as a daily activity. Here, e-bikes people are just beginning to kind of figure out how they work. So it's not they're not quite there yet.
And how much does the character of San Francisco impact on the bike culture? It's a city we know for technology, for a certain design aesthetic. Do you see that kind of played out in the kinds of bikes that people want? Are people more aware of technology when they're buying their bicycles? Are they more design aware, do you think, here?
I think it's a little of both, because the biking community breaks down into hardcore athletes. You probably have a really great number of people who are riding 50 or 100 miles on the weekends and going up and down Mount Tam and really being athletic reformers, and other people who just like a bike for getting around the city. I think it's more a kind of a progressive, driven by youth culture and just a lot of the students, but younger people kind of say, well, if I'm going to have one vehicle, probably a car isn't so optimal, and it's more a lifestyle kind of thing. I think progressive the same way our food movement and other things are, that people just think, this is a lifestyle that seems more suitable towards me as an urban resident and someone who connects with my community.
Can I just ask you personally, we were talking about food culture before here, and it seems that there's something very distinctive about San Francisco, and it delivers a certain quality of life. We were walking around yesterday. You see how people live in the city. There's something very unique and really kind of obviously special about living here. For you as a San Franciscan, what is it that makes this city deliver you a quality of life? How do you see the urban environment, and how does it work for you?
Well, I think the proximity to nature is just a fact. We have a very elegant and dramatic landscape, so you're surrounded by hills and the bay, and that kind of contrast is really both seductive and something that is just enjoyable. We're also a city of small neighborhoods, and with convenient access to these different neighborhoods, and the ability to, I bike around, I scoot around, I walk a lot, but on your own 2 feet and very easily, you can have access to so many different kind of rich cultural experiences in a very close and personal manner, like on a daily basis. So I think it's that just close personal collection with the people that run the shops and stores in your hood, and the different people who you see on the street.
Rob, I mentioned in my introduction to you that you were quite a pioneer of sort of e-tail with furniture and design within reach. And public bikes is, what's the split between people buying from your South Park store and buying online? And do you notice that people are more willing to buy bikes online rather than furniture?
No, furniture's a little easier. Bikes are a little trickier, but it's a similar kind of phenomenon, that about 60% of our sales are done online all around the country. Gosh. And about 40% are done through our store and through other stores. The nice thing about a bike, like any kind of vehicle, if you sit on it and feel it and ride around on it, you have a different kind of relationship to it. So we have a nice kind of test ride center where our store is in South Park in San Francisco. And this is especially good for the people who haven't ridden a bike for a while. They can come down and sit on one and ride around and feel very comfortable. And that tangible thing makes a big difference.
I know we've spoken about this before, but sort of my stumbling block with buying furniture and design online is the fact that it's something you live with, you want to try out. And right. I'd imagine that was the same for a bike.
Yeah, it's similar, but I think in the U.S. we're so accustomed to buying things directly and online, and we have the confidence, well, if you don't like it, fine, you can return it, and there's the barriers are much lower, and people have just become accustomed to it.
And people trust you.
Trust you. I remember, 15 or 20 years ago, we were importing, Stilton cheeses and prosciutto. People aren't going to buy that kind of food online. No, they do. People buy mattresses online. I mean, it's just a fact of American culture, whether we're voracious consumers or what, but we tend to be attracted to that as a vehicle.
I wanted to ask you, looking more generally at what San Francisco can teach other cities, not just in the US but around the world. We've been talking a lot today about the certain type of person that lives in San Francisco and the certain type of business that can survive. Are there things that you think happen here that could equally happen in other cities if they had the right infrastructure or the right people in government? Or are there certain things that are just very specific to this area?
I think that's a great question. I think we're such an interesting melting pot in terms of being on the Pacific Rim and having the influence of Asian culture and having a large Hispanic population and such a broad mixture of people that the ethnic roots run so deep and so broad that I think that the tolerance for different groups of people is quite unique here. And I don't know how that gets spread to other places. I feel a similar phenomenon if I'm in New York because of the eclectic nature of the population and all that. I think the level of probably comfort with change that we have, San Francisco being leader in food and in retail and different things where, good ideas or new ideas are welcome and they're received gladly. I think that we're very much just open to change as being the nature of maybe going back to the 60s and flower power.
I was just wondering, though, before we get too utopian about it, there must be some challenges for San Francisco, because I think we've painted it such a rosy picture now.
They're massive. And if you took transportation, we have one of the homeliest subways like in the universe. I mean, if you get on BART, which was developed in the 60s and 70s, if you fly into San Francisco Airport and get on BART and you look at the dowdy upholstery and the somewhat depressing nature of it, you feel like you're in a third world kind of transportation system. It's not in any ways idyllic that way. I think we've inherited an incredible legacy of a beautiful topography and interesting and diverse architecture.
And again, a personal question, the other thing that just can't help but strike you when you're walking around the city is the homeless issue. Yeah. Is that something that's still kind of, when you live here all the time, that weighs on your mind?
I think we probably know, but I think that, for better or worse, we probably approach them like the hills in San Francisco. People find different ways of not dealing with some of the stuff that's right in front of them. We know it's an issue, and I think it's an important issue politically and socially and all that, but I think we all tend to find our own little routes around.
Rob Forbes, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for coming in. You're listening to a very special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from San Francisco. We're back right after this.
This is Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After another Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to a very special edition of Midori House here in San Francisco, and we're almost at the end.
No.
Oh, no.
And at the end of our trip, which actually makes me feel so homesick. I'm so desperate to move here.
Really?
Yes. How can you be homesick for somewhere that's not your home?
Well, it's a long story, Andrew.
In reverse.
I don't
your
have soul's a home.
Here.
Yeah. It's my spiritual home.
I think what was great about all the guests today, they kind of lived up to the San Francisco type. They're all kind of, when we were just speaking to Casey, he was like a real kind of, tech person, that people lived outdoors, a celebration.
Chad is the surfer baker.
Chad, I just got back from Nicaragua surfing last night.
I like it. I feel like we've had a very good cross section of all the things that people sort of think about when they think of San Francisco.
We have indeed. And that is absolutely all we've got time for, I'm afraid, on this very special edition from San Francisco of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Aisha Spears and Barrett Austin. Our studio engineer here at KQED, the wonderful KQED, was Paul Lang. The new episode of Culture with Robert Bound is next, right after the news. We're going to play you out with a song, a sort of a San Francisco, California song. It's The Grateful Dead with Sugar Magnolia. From all of us here in San Francisco, thanks for tuning in and goodbye.
Blossoms blooming, heads all empty, and I don't care. So